Ken Rudin has asked to be excused from the podcast this week in deference to the tragic story of former Congressman Massa.
Now they're saying I groped a male staffer. Yeah, I did. Not only did I grope him, I tickled him until he couldn't breathe, and then four guys jumped on top of me. It's my 50th birthday.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin, in for Andrea Seabrook.
Oh, well, I'm so glad to have you with us, Andrea.
Thank you.
You are the perfect person to join us this week. The fact of the matter is, Ken is on vacation, but it is highly appropriate that we have you instead for two reasons. One, because you cover the House, and you can tell us about most of all the important developments that went on in Washington this week, because they all were in the House of Representatives. And two, it's appropriate to have you because you're not Ken Rudin.
And I'm prettier.
I shouldn't respond to that at all.
No, you
shouldn't.
I shouldn't respond to that. I would have to report you to the Ethics Committee, Ron.
And, of course, within the next 6 to 18 months, they might actually have a response.
They might.
So let's deal with healthcare first, because
Substance.
This is the major issue facing our republic, and it is a great challenge to the institution that you cover, your beloved House of Representatives. Are they going to vote for what we are loosely calling the president's plan on healthcare, or aren't they?
Well, you know, just as somebody who's been covering the House for the last year, I have to say there were a few moments where I really resented the fact that all eyes were on the Senate.
Only a few moments?
And then the moment that they decided to go with reconciliation, bam, it was a House story.
It's a total reversal on the usual difficulty
scale,
where usually the majority in the House is enough, and
that's
all you really need to worry about. But the House has always had problems with the bill, and many people had forgotten that it was difficult just getting to the 218 that they needed to get a majority.
Right, they got 220
last year.
220 to 215 is how it passed. Now, remember, how it passed was with stricter abortion language than there is in the Senate bill now. But it was much more costly and had a public option. So if you're in the middle of the road now, you're a moderate to conservative Democrat trying to decide whether to vote for this bill, you're looking at abortion language you don't like very much.
Because it isn't as strict as you say.
But a bill that costs a lot less, does more to lower the deficit over 10 years, and doesn't have a public option.
So you don't get in trouble where your state, where they're very likely already passing a bill that is supposedly going to opt out.
So you've got sort of these guys in the middle, the Jason Altmaiers, the Blue Dogs, really, who voted against the bill in the first place, and now they're trying to decide what they do. And they have to sort of weigh lower cost against less strong abortion language. And, you know, if I shake up my magic eight ball, I would say right now that signs point to yes.
Barely.
There are 12 Democrats, including Bart Stupak of Michigan, the sort of leader of anti-abortion legislation in the House, who have said to Nancy Pelosi, we will not vote for this bill if it has the Senate language. It looks like the Senate language is going to stay in at this point. So the question is, there are just a few more Democrats who may actually vote for it, you know, and the numbers are being counted up now.
And yet those final numbers remain very much in question, including what is a majority in the House of Representatives. Since they had that vote you mentioned at 220 back last year, we have seen four Democrats depart, three resignations and one death.
Yes.
John Murtha died.
Pennsylvania.
Neil Abercrombie has resigned from Hawaii.
Running for governor.
Robert Wexler resigned in Florida, not running for anything. And then, of course, we had the famous case of Eric Massa,
who was tickled out of office.
So we will get back to speaking of the illustrious and notorious Mr. Massa in a moment. But what is a majority in the House?
A majority of the House before the Massa disaster was 216. Now, I think it's 215 and a half. So probably it stays at 216.
So it's still 216. Yeah. To get a bare majority.
Hang in. Who knows what will happen in the next few days the way this is all going. A lot of unexpected things have happened over the last couple of weeks.
So the critical hours have arrived in the House. Everything is still hanging fire in the Senate. And the president has been out on the stump this week. He's been going around the country trying to make his final case for health care. He's going to make one more stop in Cleveland in the next few days. And then he's going to go stump for health care in Indonesia. Do I have this correct?
Right.
What good does it do his most critical legislative issue for him to be in Asia as we come down to the vote in the House?
I think it can't be good in the House. I mean, it's going to take every little bit of energy to get this thing through the House. And to have the president not there, the health care commander-in-chief, it doesn't muster all the energy That's all I'm saying.
It doesn't muster all the answers. Exactly. It's going to leave a huge question mark. If they don't get it, a lot of the responsibility is going to fall back on the White House. That would happen in any event, I suppose. But in 2009, when you had the economy in some kind of free fall, and when you had the president still saying that after they got the economic stimulus through, healthcare was number one. That was the top priority. Mm-hmm. Even then, when they were talking that talk, they were traveling all over the world. They were going to Cairo to address the Islamic world. They were traveling to Europe. They were traveling to Asia. The president was all over the place. And that's a lot of foreign travel in a first year for a guy who's trying to change all the rules on not only healthcare, but climate change, financial regulations for Wall Street, eventually immigration, which the White House is talking about again.
Energy.
Just about every major system that the federal government tries to regulate was in some sense or another in play, and the president was spending a lot of time overseas being a world figure. And here, after being promised that was going to end, at this critical moment, they don't want to cancel their trip to Indonesia.
When you talk to people in the House and the Senate, they will tell you that what's been missing in the healthcare debate, the reason it's taken so long, is because the president hasn't been a good enough leader or shepherd or, you know, pick your metaphor. He hasn't been there to hammer the heads that need to be hammered and you know, make the threats and the bargains. And
well, it needs to be said, I suppose, that back in 93 and 94, the White House was criticized and told they were responsible for the failure to overhaul the health care system because they presented their own plan and insisted on it,
right,
and didn't let Congress make its own amendments and do a bill of its own. So we've gone from one extreme to the other extreme, and perhaps we're winding up at the same point. But your gut at this point still is that the House can approve this.
Well, I think that, you know, all these lawmakers, C-SPAN, you know, they sit there with their news channel or their C-SPAN on all day, seeing the president there every day or every few days giving confident, hard-nosed, eyes set sort of speeches about getting this through.
Good on this stuff.
It makes a difference in the House.
Puts a little bit of steel back in the spine.
It does. So if it comes down to the moment and he's not there, I don't know.
And of course, the House is always dealing with some degree of distractions. This week, there has been a story that everyone in Washington was talking about, a story that just appealed to those instincts that I guess are in all of us and just irresistible in some of us. And of course, I'm talking here about earmarking.
Yes. Oh.
So Chairman of the Appropriations Committee David Obey says, and his subcommittee chairman for defense, Norm Dick, says that they're going to stop putting earmarks in defense bills for for-profit companies. There's a forehead slapper.
Okay. It sounds like it's got a lot of ifs in it. You know, a lot of dependent clauses.
You don't see the end of Murthaism yet.
I really don't. It's just too hard to imagine the system working that differently. Now, I should say, to people who don't exactly follow this very closely, that getting rid of private company earmarks is a big deal. It is the worst offender of earmarks. It's what gives earmarks the name that it has.
And the name that it has is corruption.
Pork. Corruption.
Well, it's corruption.
It's
because
corruption.
You talk about
bribery.
People,
is the word.
The allegation that has been made over the years and that has led to many an uncomfortable session of the House Ethics Committee, Senate Ethics Committee, is if you earmark something in an appropriations bill for a company or for some entity, and then down the road that entity manages to support your political future by giving money to one of your campaigns, is that not a one hand washes the other form of corruption?
And it often goes the other direction, that a company will give money to a campaign and then that person sitting on the right committee will go and secure the earmark for the company. I mean, it's pretty hard not to draw the circle. It sure looks like pay to play politics.
It certainly does. And the big block here is in the Senate, where I don't hear anybody on the Senate Appropriations Committee saying that they want to match this, if you will, initiative that's coming from the House.
No. And let me make one other point, and that is that the people who are accused of this will tell you, I'm not ashamed of bringing jobs to my district. I'm not ashamed of putting an earmark into that bill that brings a company or keeps a company in my district that employs 1,000 people. So there are reasonable answers at times to these questions. But yes, there's no indication that this will happen in the Senate. And I think when you get down to it, you're going to have to see whether the House is really committed to this if they decide they won't go with a conference report that the Senate has put earmarks in and the House hasn't. If you can't reconcile those, you have no bill. You have no appropriations.
You know, sometimes I wonder if the House and Senate are really part of the same Congress. I've heard that there's a certain degree of rivalry between the two chambers. Have you observed that in your experience, Andrea?
have I observed it. You know, everyone outside of Washington thinks the enemies are Republicans versus Democrats. The House versus the Senate is really the big gladiator fight in Washington. Not only do the senators constantly hate the way the House works with their silly rules and their short debates and hot-headed thinking, but
1-minute speeches. That's got to be a violation of nature.
The House hates the Senate for their all 100 of them think they're president of the United States, and they all, you know, give these like hour-long speeches and whatever. They can't stand the way each other works. This was by design, by the way. It's supposed to be the Senate is the cooling saucer to the House hot teacup, right? Or whatever Jefferson said. I'm never good at quoting that.
That's good enough. That's good enough. I've always thought that metaphor was kind of
so
tortured
odd.
And odd.
It really is.
You know, as though everything were a tea party.
Anyway, you know, it comes right down to even within the building. When I first started in the Congress in 2003, the House and the Senate cafeterias used different debit card systems. You had to have a different debit card to buy a hamburger in the House than you did in the Senate. The Capitol Police are separated into two groups of people, House and Senate workers.
And how well do they get along?
They hate each other for having to work different weekends. I mean, you know, it's unbelievable how deep the rift goes. I mean, there are different engineers who work at the trains underneath the Capitol.
I'm not sure that the framers ever really foresaw there being trains running underneath the Capitol, or for that matter, large police forces guarding the House and the Senate,
that's
although
true.
God knows we need them. Yeah. The question is, what was on their mind when they designed a Congress and said, we're going to have the House full of one kind of people and the Senate full of another kind of people? Of course, they all had to be white males, because in those days, were the only people who were allowed to participate in politics.
Yeah.
But they were going to be in the House, they were going to be closer to the people, and in the Senate, they were going to be, if you will, the sort of elevated solons who would be chosen by the individual state legislators, not by the voters.
Right.
And so these were terribly different bodies, and they were going to be bringing very different views of legislation to their work. And then our blessed framers of the Constitution required them to pass every bill in identical form. Identical form.
Right. It's kind of beautiful.
Identical form, which is almost impossible under the best of conditions, even when you're working with people you agree with and want to cooperate with.
Even when everybody agrees on the same goal, it's just impossible to get there. I mean, you'll notice one of the side products of this is when a senator leaves office or dies or something like that, there are several different ways a new senator can take that place. They might be appointed by the governor. They might be elected by the legislature. They may be elected by the people, depending on the state laws. The House, there is not a member of the House that is not elected. It is impossible to be appointed to a House office by writ of the Constitution. You can't be there unless you're elected by the people. So they really are totally different bodies. And you'll notice the difference in the kind of person that gets put in those seats.
Among other things, because of the enormous expense of running statewide in any state that has any kind of large media, people in the Senate increasingly have to be personally wealthy. There's just not a way to raise enough money to run in many states. In a few states, you can still run with a small amount of money. But you need $5, $10, $15, $20 million, even in middle-sized states, to be a competitive candidate. And a lot of senators are relying on personal wealth. So it's certainly not a new thing for there to be millionaires in the Senate, but it's become almost a millionaire's club, and it's an exception to the rule to find someone who is even upper middle class or only slightly wealthy.
Sure. There are members of the House that have been elected there solely based on a campaign of wanting to be on the Agriculture Committee from those farm states. Their only mandate is to be on the Agriculture Committee. So they're really different places. For example, this week in the House, we had a debate on the war in Afghanistan, something that hasn't happened in the Senate in a long time. In fact, it hasn't really happened in the House. This was the first time that there's been an open debate on the war in Afghanistan, the actual policy, since 2001 when the war began.
Should we be there or shouldn't we?
Should we be there or shouldn't we?
Should we pull out in 30 days, I believe? Wasn't that the proposition?
30 days or the end of the year. But yes, that wasn't connected to the actual funding for the war itself. And when you connect it with the funding, you know, to vote against the funding is to vote against the troops.
How can we not back our boys?
Exactly.
And women.
Exactly. So we had a real 3 hours, which is a lot on the House side. I know it's not over there in the Senate, but it is a lot in the House, of real debate about it. And it was fascinating to watch just, you know, the ideas of war and peace, the elemental sort of basic questions that a Congress of a nation like this should be asking was really happening there.
And in this particular instance, the House was forced to this in a sense. I mean, Nancy Pelosi agreed to have this debate and have a vote on it, largely in confidence that the war itself would not be rejected by a majority of the House. But she felt that for that minority that feels strongly against the war, she should have the debate and have the vote. And the congressman who was urging this, who has been identified with the peace side of the argument all through the post-9/11 period, was Dennis Kucinich.
Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich, former presidential candidate. Yeah, it was interesting to watch how the Congress was split up by this debate, because you had a bunch of progressive liberals who were going to vote against it for reasons of wanting to go after peace or wanting to use the money for things at home. And then you had five Republicans who are really libertarians,
led by Ron Paul,
another former presidential candidate. also voting against the war. And so you had this group of people voting against the war for wildly different reasons, but joining together in a coalition. And then you had the rest of the Congress voting for the war, even though they were voting for it for wildly different reasons. There were people who just wanted to support the troops, people who wanted to finish the mission, people who wanted to support President Obama in the first big military push of his career as commander-in-chief of this military. And it was by far the most bipartisan vote we've had in the House this year. So it was really fascinating to watch.
Andrea, with all these serious issues that are going on in the House, really, this week, the mass media turned into the Massa media.
It sure did.
Well, what are the basic facts here? Eric Massa has resigned in some degree of disgrace after being accused of having made improper advances to male staffers, perhaps including an intern or two, although none of this is really documented or on the record. It's just what's been out there, as we say.
You can't call it a whisper campaign, though. When the guy goes on Glenn Beck on Fox News this week and says, "Sure, I grew up my staffers."
But it wasn't sexual.
What?
Well, it's either sexual or it's aggravated assault.
It's so outlandish to hear any congressman
talking this way about how they're acting.
Talking about living in a townhouse with a bunch of young male staffers.
Bachelors.
It's so salacious, and he's so offhanded about it. That
I think that's the shocking part, isn't it? The way he himself talks, the terms he's introduced into the Washington argot.
Yes, like,
it's quite a list.
Such as?
Fracking, snorkeling, Massa massage.
These are terms we will not forget long after we have forgotten the scandal.
Does this take us to, in some sense or another, a new consciousness of the individual congressional personality? I mean, will the country look to Washington? And sure, there's been this extraordinarily low, somewhere in the teens, approval. You got to wonder who the people are who approve of Congress nowadays, right? They can't be liberals. They can't be conservatives. They can't be terribly high-minded people. On the other hand, you know, who are they? Who are the 18% or whatever the number is that say they approve of Congress right now? We've got questions of honesty. We've got questions of intelligence. And now this behavior standard is below lowest common denominator.
Yeah. And you know what? The Democrats will write this off as this being one crazy man. And there's a lot of truth in that. But when the only thing that a person out in, you know, a state far from Washington hears about Washington is about Eric Massa, then they generalize that to Congress. And it just adds to what we already know is a huge anti-incumbent mood going into these elections in the fall. If people think, oh, well, that's what's going on in Washington, well, I'm just going to throw them all out. Well, then both parties have something to worry about, but especially Democrats.
Because, after all, they have more seats and they are seen as the party in charge.
Exactly.
And whether they're in charge of Eric Massa or anyone else, you're absolutely right about the way human beings think about generalizing from a specific example.
What are those bozos doing?
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Andrea Seabrook, and for Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week when Ken Rudin returns, really this time, to It's All Politics from NPR. That's right, hit the road, Jack. Don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack. And don't you come back no more. What you say? Hit the road. Away, but I'll be back on my feet someday.